This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Car sales accelerate in March.
We take a look at everything from the hybrid to the SUV.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org for Tuesday, April 3rd.
Coming up, it's the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. I'll talk with the oceanographer who discovered the wreck.
And a government agency takes heat for a lavish conference in Nevada.
It's all coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Car sales in March are coming out this morning. So far, it looks like the strongest month in 4 years for the auto industry. Chrysler reported sales rose 34%, and General Motors said some models set records.
Also, Ford says its sales were the best in years. And that is where we will start now with Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So it seems like high gas prices don't seem to have deterred people from going out and buying cars.
Only to some extent. Of course, everybody's going to be watching it, because if more of your money is going into the gas tank, that's less available to spend other places. But the key with the automotive industry is, do you have a job? And that's what we're watching out for. Jobs are picking up, or at least stabilizing in certain areas, and as long as we see growth in the job area, you're going to see a pickup in auto sales.
Well, I know that we saw that GM said that it sold a record amount of these fuel-efficient cars, cars that get better than 30 miles a gallon on the highway. Are people going out and buying the really fuel-efficient cars like the Nissan Leaf, these electric cars?
Well, if you take a look at the Volt and some of those, they're going to be on an extended vacation here simply because they're too expensive, and it really is still experimental technology that you're looking at here. Fuel efficiency is the key thing. Foreign competition really gave us the push to fuel efficiency. You know, 5-6 years ago, you basically had a choice about among three different fuel-efficient vehicles, and the rest were all guzzlers. Now you've got about 40 from which to choose, and you don't have to buy a car you can barely squeeze into. So the options are out there. People are moving in that direction, and the key is fuel efficiency.
And Julie, quickly, where are we now compared to pre-crash levels when it comes to car sales?
Well, before the crash, we were selling almost 17 million a year. That was in 2005. Now, we've plunged all the way down, but we're climbing back. 2011, we were 12.8. It looks like this year we could be on back at 14 million, but it's still a long, slow haul back.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
As you just heard, General Motors said fuel-efficient cars were selling better than ever. With high gas prices, is that a trend that's likely to last? Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
Consumers may be buying more hybrids and smaller cars, but it's probably not any kind of lasting trend.
There's no correlation mathematically between the sales of a vehicle in a segment and its fuel economy.
Eric Noble is an auto consultant with Car Lab.
If the widely reported shift to small cars had really happened, Fiat would be in great shape and they'd be sold out of Fiat 500s. They're not.
He says consumers who bought hybrids were already planning to. Higher gas prices just provided that extra push. More broadly, for the industry as a whole, sales are up. But David Cole with the Center for Automotive Research says better car company profits have more to do with cutting costs.
Now the industry is profitable because of the massive restructuring that has occurred.
U.S. automakers have slashed employees, factories, and benefits. If sales rebound further, Cole says the industry is poised to be very profitable. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Not so long ago, the auto industry was all about the sales of SUVs and large trucks. So where are those sales now, and what does that say about the economy? Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the story for us.
March is the start of the all-important spring sales season. George Magliano is a senior economist at IHS Automotive. He says truck sales have been holding steady at about 7 million a month. He sees more steady growth down the road.
It's being led by small businesses coming back, individual contractors, even a little bit on construction.
Those small business owners are buying new pickups, vans, and SUVs. Magliano says strong truck sales point to an improving economy because businesses wouldn't be buying something new if they weren't making money. Even some of the last holdouts, people who clung to their creaky old pickups during the recession, are showing up in showrooms. Ivan Drury is a senior automotive analyst at Edmunds.com.
If you look at the vehicles that are being traded in for this month compared to the previous Marches, you'll see that they're on average about a year older.
Drury says higher gas prices are also driving sales. People want to get rid of their old gas guzzlers. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
A new report from the General Services Administration's Inspector General says government officials spent hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars on a training conference near Las Vegas. And the money wasn't only going to binders and bag lunches. Now the head of the GSA has resigned. Two deputies were fired. And Marketplace's David Gura joins me now from Washington with more. Good morning, David.
Morning, Stacey.
So the GSA is an independent agency that manages federal office space and buildings. What was it spending so much money on at this conference?
When you look at this list, it's kind of unbelievable, Stacey. This was a four-day training conference for 300 employees held at the M Resort and Casino. That's in Henderson, Nevada, just south of Las Vegas. There was a $31,000 reception with a clown, and a mind reader, okay? And there were $44 breakfasts, and there was so much sushi, $7,000 worth of sushi.
Wow.
And as if that wasn't memorable enough, they gave you something to remember the training conference by, a commemorative coin, Stacey. All those together cost more than $6,000. And in the end, the total cost for this weekend, this four-day weekend training conference, was $823,000.
That is pretty amazing. David, tell me, how can waste like this be prevented?
Well, I should say, this spending was against the rules. There are strict guidelines in place for conferences like this one. How much you can spend on a hotel room, for instance, what's the maximum you can pay for breakfast. This is creating quite a bit of buzz on Capitol Hill, as you might imagine. Independent Senator Joe Lieberman has called this a stupid and infuriating waste of taxpayer dollars. I just talked to Republican Congressman Mike Turner. He's on the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. And he says you can bet there are going to be hearings on this. And in the future, Congress has to keep a closer watch on agency budgets.
I mean, there's a tremendous amount of waste in government spending when we have trillion-dollar deficits. This is an excellent example of the type of dollars that the administration needs to pursue and save for the taxpayers.
Now, Congressman Turner isn't alone. A lot of lawmakers are saying this incident shows the federal government has gotten too big, Stacey, and that federal spending is out of control.
David Gura in Washington. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
If you're a regular user of Facebook or Twitter, you're likely familiar with the Kony 2012 video. That's the controversial video about a Ugandan warlord, Joseph Kony. The half-hour-long video has been viewed more than 100 million times, and now the group behind it is preparing Kony 2012 Part 2, Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
The first Kony 2012 video included this preamble.
The next 27 minutes are an experiment. But in order for it to work, you have to pay attention.
And pay attention people did. The video was all over social media sites. It broke viral records, but criticism poured in as well about the finances of the group that made it and the film's accuracy. Barbie Zelizer is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. She says the video highlights the strengths and weaknesses of new media.
its easiness and the smoothness of its delivery and the widespread nature of how easily it was shared hides the fact that it was simple and it was unidimensional and it was erroneous.
Zelizer hopes the new video will offer corrections and help contextualize the situation, but still,
the same people who accessed the first video may not be the same people who accessed the second.
In the new media sphere, messages go out quickly, without much control over what happens next. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Now it's time for the global perspective on business and economics. An oil rig off the coast of Scotland has been leaking oil into the North Sea. The rig is owned by French gas company Total and is costing millions of dollars a day in lost revenue and attempted repairs. The BBC's Colin Blaine joins us now from Scotland. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning.
Colin, put this leak in context for us, if you will. How big is it, both for Total and for the oil industry?
Well, it's a pretty serious problem for Total. Firstly, because it's costing the company a lot of money. They're losing $1.5 million every day in lost revenue, and they're spending $1 million a day trying to fix the leak from the Elgin platform. But more than that, the problem for them is that they don't know how long this will take to repair. There are two things they can do. They can drill a relief well, which would take at least 6 months and would be very expensive, or it may be that they can plug the well by pumping heavy mud down into it. But expensive either way.
So plugging the hole would be the faster solution?
It would be the faster solution, but also there is a safety issue there too, because at the moment, gas, flammable gas, is leaking out into the air around the platform. And of course, if you put people back on board, then there must be some risk of ignition. And anyone who does that will have to be an expert. They've been consulting experts. They've been consulting people who helped sort out the problem with Deepwater Horizon in the Gulf of Mexico 2 years ago. So they've been speaking to those who know best in the industry, taking opinion from experts from everywhere.
And you've spoken with some Total workers who were there when the accident happened. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it happened very suddenly. They were alerted to the escape of gas by a standby ship, which is there to keep a watch on things. And they were removed by helicopter. The workers were bundled on board. There was no time to collect personal belongings, passports, anything like that. But I'm told that it was a very smooth operation. But understandably, those who are waiting to be lifted off as the gas filtered around them were extremely anxious and very pleased when they finally were able to get away from the platform.
The BBC's Colin Blaine in Scotland. Colin, thank you.
Thanks very much indeed.
Well, across Europe, the experts have so far had a hard time figuring out what to do if a country like Greece decides to leave the euro. So a British businessman named Lord Wolfson set up a contest in search of breakup ideas. The prize is $300,000, and today five finalists were named. From London, here's the BBC's Sarah Stolarz.
The prize is the second biggest in economics after the Nobel Prize. 435 entries were whittled down to just five finalists. That includes a practical guide to leaving the euro by economist Roger Bootle. In it, he grapples with the adoption of a new currency by the departing country.
Countries in this position needn't fear the fall of a new currency on the exchanges, which will undoubtedly happen. They should embrace it. It's part of the solution, not the problem.
The official winner will be announced in July. It was not just economists that entered the competition. A 10-year-old Dutch boy, Jure Hermans, was the youngest entrant. He received a special $100 prize for his one-page plan, which included a diagram of a Greek man with a sad face. In London, I'm the BBC's Sarah Stolarz for Marketplace.
So the first ever World Happiness Report by the United Nations and Columbia's Earth Institute is out. And guess who tops the list? Do you have any idea, Jeremy?
It's always those Scandinavian countries, right?
Well, you got it. Denmark, Norway, and Finland topped the list. And the least happy countries included Togo and Sierra Leone. The results are in line with previous studies done by Gallup and others. But why did the UN start to worry about the overall happiness this year?
Here to talk with us for our Midday Extra is Richard Layard, who co-authored the study. Welcome.
Hello there.
Well, why did the UN decide to look at happiness for the first time this year?
Well, of course, there's a growing feeling worldwide that there's more to life than the gross national product. and that what ultimately matters is the happiness that people get from their lives. it's a wonderful moment when this has bubbled through to the centerpiece of the international community. And we are really excited this has happened. The initiative was taken by the country of Bhutan, which is a very interesting small country in the Himalayas,
right.
Whose king decided 40 years ago that the aim of his government was not the gross national product, but the gross national happiness. And this, of course, actually has profound implications for the priorities for any country. And that's what this report is about. What do we know about the levels of happiness in different countries? How do we explain them? What are the main causes of happiness? And what kind of policy implications follow from it?
Actually, the Bhutan, which you just mentioned, one of our former colleagues here at Marketplace, Lisa Napoli, wrote a book all about that and about measuring the happiness of people instead of the money.
Yes, indeed.
Well, Richard, to dig into the happiness topic a little bit more, what are some of the main factors that determine happiness?
Oh, the factors, of course, the main factors are on the external side, the social support that you have, the strength of your family and your friendship connections, whether you're happy at work, whether you're living in a society in which people treat each other with respect. And on the internal side, the biggest single determinant is your mental health, which is very, very much more important than factors like income. Income, of course, matters, but it is much less important to people than it is often thought compared with other factors which people just take for granted.
Can you make, though, a judgment on a country's happiness when obviously in every country there are going to be people in very different situations?
Yes, I mean, the data show you everything. They show you the distribution of happiness, just like they show you, if you look at income, the distribution of income, and there are different factors affecting everybody. But there's one other really important point that I wanted to get across in relation to why the UN is interested, which is that in 2015, the Millennium Goals come to an end. Those are the goals certainly the poorer countries of the world have been working towards as part of a pledge they made in 2000. And these goals are to be replaced by sustainable development goals, which would probably apply to all countries. And one of the real issues is whether these goals ought not to include the happiness of the people. Now, the UN General Assembly in July passed a resolution that the governments of the world should pay more attention to the happiness of the people. And that is why this conference was mandated. And the issue will be debated again by the UN General Assembly in 2013. And hopefully this will lead to the inclusion of the happiness of the people as one of the goals of sustainable development for the future of the world.
Any surprises on the list for you?
Well, I'll tell you the nicest surprise was a country which was very high, which I didn't know too much about, which is Costa Rica. We had yesterday at our meeting the president of Costa Rica, a most wonderful lady, who was explaining to us some of the reasons why. This is a country that has been giving a great deal of attention to the social support of its people and promotion of mutual respect, but also, of course, to the preservation of ecology. And in a fully sustainable economy, we would have a good happiness level for the people, but also, of course, a sustainable economy that was not robbing the planet of its future.
Richard Layard co-authored the World Happiness Report from the United Nations and Columbia's Earth Institute. Richard, thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Next week, we'll mark 100 years since the maiden voyage of the RMS Titanic. And you may have heard that the director of the movie Titanic, James Cameron, just made a solo voyage down to the deepest part of the ocean. Meanwhile, the CEO of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, just reported that a team he funded found the Apollo 11 engines deep beneath the Atlantic. Joining us now to talk about all this is oceanographer Robert Ballard, who discovered the Titanic wreck in 1985. He's now advising the search for Amelia Earhart's plane. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to have you here. Well, there's been a lot of deep sea exploration news lately, and I want to get your thoughts on some of this. You're a scientist. What do you make of these celebrities going down and doing all this deep sea exploration?
Well, I think it's, you know, always wonderful when people draw attention to the ocean. And I think also it's very apropos since with the Law of the Sea Convention, half of the United States of America lies beneath the sea. And I think people are starting to turn their focus back onto the planet itself. I don't think people think we're really going to live on Mars in any significant number. And the ocean is taking on a greater importance because of its natural resources that we're discovering, human history that we're discovering. So I think it's very timely.
But what do you think it says that it was a private citizen and not a government or a research institution that made it down to the farthest reaches of the ocean? James Cameron, I'm talking about.
Well, you know, the government did go down there in 1960 to the very spot. Cameron's dive was the first solo dive, but humans had been there before.
Yes, they went back down there in the 1960s, but this is 2012, and the person who did it is not somebody from the Navy. It's James Cameron.
A lot of firsts are done by adventurous individuals who scale a mountain and show that it can be done, and then things follow after that. It's great that all of these people are getting involved. It's drawing a lot of attention, and I think it just bodes well for the future of the oceans.
Now, as someone who has spent so much time looking for things at the bottom of the sea, tell us what is the point of finding something like Amelia Earhart's plane at the bottom of the ocean?
There's more history in the deep sea than all the museums of the world combined. And a lot of that history is at peril. We've just recently found a ship, 500 BC, that is in a high state of preservation.
Wow.
So when you think about it, there's 1 million, estimated to be 1 million ancient shipwrecks in the deep sea. Think of all the human history that they contain. So it's also because the technology is now making it possible. Jim's dive was made through new technologies. A lot of what we're seeing is the emergence of newer technologies that make the ocean not seem so deep.
As we approach the 100th anniversary of the Titanic shipwreck, you are the guy who found the Titanic at the bottom of the ocean. What's going through your mind right now?
You know, every generation rediscovers the Titanic, and we're going through yet another phase. As you know, Cameron's movie's being re-released in 3D. There's a huge, unbelievable exhibit center being built in Belfast, Northern Ireland, where they built the Titanic. And so the 100th anniversary is sort of giving people to finally come to grips with the fact that they should embrace the Titanic as an amazing piece of technology that they built.
Robert Ballard is professor of oceanography at the Graduate School of Oceanography at the University of Rhode Island. Thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And finally, Stacy, the Greek island of Zakynthos has a lot of residents, 2% of residents there, claiming a government benefit for blindness. Now, that
wow.
is about 9 times the prevalence of blindness in other European countries.
Wow.
Seems yeah. maybe a little fishy, like some people are filling out forms that they shouldn't be. Well, the Greek health ministry is investigating, and the Wall Street Journal already did. It reported that 2 of the people claiming the blindness benefit are a bird hunter and a taxi driver, 2 professions that probably aren't good for people with sight problems.
I guess blind is in the eye of the beholder.
Oh, man. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.